Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Trump administration has quickly realized ending the Ukraine conflict is going to be difficult and time-consuming. Also, there is a growing understanding that the end of fighting does not necessarily mean creating the conditions of peace. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest Ian Proud in London. He is a senior British diplomat and author of A Misfit in Moscow, How British Diplomacy in Russia Failed. In Providence, we have Vladimir Goldstein. He is the chair of the Department of Slavic Studies at Brown University. And here in Moscow, we have Pepe Escobar. He is a geopolitical analyst and author. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Ian, I'm just going to go straight to the point. Does the Trump administration have any idea on how to approach the goal that the new president has of ending the conflict in Ukraine? Go for it.
Well, they've got more of an idea than the previous administration, which had no idea at all. I think they have a desire to do it. Let's see if Trump can get on the phone to Putin as soon as possible. The harder challenge will be to get Zelensky to talk.
Okay. But, Vladimir, the way I've seen people talking about it within the administration and in the transatlantic world in general, and they're actually talking to themselves. Remarkably, they're not talking to the Russians yet, that they're actually thinking more along the lines of a Minsk agreement, which is an absolutely non-starter. Because the Minsk agreements weren't fulfilled is one of the reasons why we're here today. Vladimir.
Yeah, I have a feeling that as important as it is for us, this issue of Russia and Ukraine, it's not that high on Trump's agenda. So he's, you know, pursuing other issues. And consequently, I don't think he had time and kind of opportunity to see all sides of the issue. So he, of course, bragged that he's going to solve it, he's going to make people talk. But, you know, whom he's going to listen to, we have to wait till, you know, say, military-industrial complex had its say, till other people say. Because, you know, we've heard from Vance, we've heard from Musk, we've heard from other people, and they say we have to resolve it. But how do we resolve it? United States, obviously, as Trump declared, America first. They want to preserve interest. If somebody in his administration convinces him that U.S. still continue to make money off this conflict, you know, it will go on. Because I don't think, you know, there is interest. Because, you know, what United States, the only thing they stand to benefit from that is maybe in the future forging some kind of Russian-American alliance versus China. If that's kind of his interest and he's convinced it's worth doing it, then maybe he'll pursue doing it. But for the time being, I don't hear, I don't see any kind of clear goal, clear thing. And just to say, let's solve it, just to show to his voters, look, I did it, and now let me pursue my other agenda. That's, I think,
Vladimir, everything you just said might be nice and fine, but it has nothing to do with Ukraine. I guess that's the problem here. You know, Pepe, Donald Trump likes to say that he doesn't want to start wars. Okay, during his first administration, I think we could say that that was true. He didn't really end many things, but now he's president again, and he says he's against war. And maybe he wants to end this conflict in Ukraine, but he's not going to resolve the root issues of why these conflicts come about. We can talk about Ukraine. We can talk about the ongoing genocide in Gaza. I mean, the problem, I guess, from Russia's perspective is that they want to end fighting, but they don't want to have peace. There is a difference there. Pepe.
Well, the Russian reaction so far has been fascinating to watch. Which means no reaction at all. They are just waiting. For the moment, there is this disco inferno, as I coined it in my latest Sputnik column, on the other side. Lots of bombast, lots of sound and fury, but are even trying to call Peskov to set up a phone call between Trump and Putin. Nothing. And everything that was leaked across the Beltway and from Washington, and some people by the Trump administration itself, Trump 2.0 itself, points to a Minsk 3. Obviously, this is not going to work. So the Russian Putin's position is, okay, we are open for meaningful discussions. even the first phone call, and even if there is a meeting in the first 90 days or so, it's not going to be meaningful. It's going to be a fantastic spectacle for the cameras, cameras clicking everywhere, bombastic headlines everywhere, but no substance.
Well, Ian, you have experience in this field here. I mean, what is this about the phone call and setting up a meeting? I mean, at least in the old days, when great leaders met, they signed things. They had already agreed to something. So I'm kind of agreeing with Pepe here. I mean, I can see the public relations side, but if it's without any substance, it's going to hurt both Putin and Trump. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Trump and Putin obviously need to talk. And when that's scheduled and how that happens, it is another matter. But that's a key first step in any agreement taking place. I just wanted to say on the Minsk agreement, actually, the first and the second Minsk agreements weren't bad. They failed because the US and the British wanted them to fail and because the Ukrainians actually killed it just before war broke out in February 2022. So the agreements themselves weren't actually bad. It's just that we invested in their failure, and therefore they failed. But anyway, I'll leave it at that. But I mean,
Well, since you mentioned it, I appreciate it. I mean, they failed because they were supposed to fail. So why would Moscow trust the interlocutors from the West that would even be remotely suggesting something of the same? The problem here, gentlemen, is the lack of trust. Ian.
Exactly. It's an absolute lack of trust. And that lack of trust doesn't date back to 2022. It actually dates back to 2014 in the onset of the crisis. A senior figure in the Russian presidential administration told me then that in 2014 that it would take a decade at least to start to rebuild some trust. That's now going to be two decades. So there's no trust, but that, you know, conversations is a first step in actually starting slowly to rebuild that trust.
Well, I mean, but Vladimir, I mean, you know, You said in your first answer that it's not really a top priority for the Trump administration. Well, what accounts for the Russian economy is failing, the Russians have a million casualties? Where is this coming from? I mean, is he just shooting from the hip? Is this what his intelligence people are telling him? I mean, I can tell you most people that know what's going on with this crisis just kind of laughed out their sleeves. I mean, why is he saying this? Is this part of a negotiating gambit? Vladimir.
Yeah, I don't think he is really aware of the kind of the root of the problem. That is, you know, probably he's fed this information because they still talk about something which probably belongs to 20th century. That is, you know, sanctions and we'll have to limit Russian export of oil and things of that nature. While I didn't hear him addressing the fundamental issue that NATO on Russian borders is existential threat. They understand when Israel said, such and such situation is existential threat, we're going to fight. They don't understand it in case of Russia. This is a serious issue. First of all, they say no more threats, no more NATO. We're basically, according to original ideas of NATO, we have to stay around Germany. So far, we didn't hear this. So the talk of I'm going to do sanctions greater than any other sanctions, it's, you know, it's a sign that they don't understand what actually provoked the whole thing to begin with. Plus, there is no real talk of sort of reining in totally kind of this, policies of Ukraine, this kind of neo-Nazi policies, banning Russian language, banning Russian culture, you know, mistreating people. These are two sore points, you know, existential threat to Russia and, you know, their neighbors, their friends, their brothers acting up like they were born again Nazis. These are unacceptable. I don't think he so far addressed it. I'm going to, you know, make Zelensky and Putin talk about war.
About what? That's the problem here. You know, Pepe, you're a frequent visitor to Moscow, and you know, sanctions is always one tool in the toolbox for the American administration, be it Biden or Trump. When you visit Moscow, how do you see sanctions impacting the country?
There's no impact. In this past 2 years, I spent almost 6 months. Both years in Moscow and traveling around, Vladivostok, Kazan, St. Petersburg, Sochi, etc. You see minor inconveniences, but you don't see the practical effect of sanctions, first of all. And everything that is being fed to Trump so far in this, let's say, the first 10 days or so, is being fed by the CIA, and it's completely absurd in terms of the absolutely dreadful state of the Russian economy, unemployment. They have no money, and they cannot sell their energy, etc. This is ridiculous. It's the opposite of what we see when we are here, in fact. So Trump is positioning himself in a way. So far, it looks like he's positioning himself to a non-dialogue or a dialogue that will go nowhere. And then that can be blamed on Putin and Russia. This is a very, very straightforward negotiating tactic, but it's not going to work as well because it's up to then the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Russia and to Putin themselves to tell, look, he doesn't want to talk about substance because, for instance, he doesn't even understand the meaning of indivisibility of security. So we have to go back to late 2019, those famous letters that were sent to the previous administration. They didn't respond. And this was a proposal for a serious dialogue. And in Ukraine was and is included in this big discussion about indivisibility of security, Europe and the post-Soviet space. Nobody in Trump's circle apparently mentioned that to him.
Well, Ian, again, being a diplomat, it seems that, you know, this core issue of security, which I want to talk about in the second part of the program, is largely absent from the conversation. Ian, before we go to the break.
Well, Trump actually recognized that NATO membership is a big strategic issue for Russia. And I think he's hinted that that should be taken off the table. I've been clear for a long time that that has to be taken off the table for peace talks to move forward. That appears to me by far the biggest stumbling block. Look forward to getting into that discussion in more detail.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I can appreciate the Trump wanting to end the conflict. But the problem is that he's not addressing the root causes of how it came about. And this is, you know, something, you know, the Cold War was never resolved satisfactorily. It should have been, and we're living with the consequences of that today. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the Ukraine situation. Well, as it often is, during the break, some of the most important things are said. So I'm going to return to them for the broadcast here. Ian, let me go back to you here. I mean, why should Trump end this war? I mean, a lot of people are profiting from it. The Europeans slavishly do what they're told. The Americans will sell them really high energy. I mean, if it's not broken, why fix it? I mean, that's what the cynic would say, and I think that's a sentiment that you can find in some Western capitals. Ian?
Well, the Europeans can't afford to keep paying for the war, and the Americans don't want to keep paying for the war. And actually, you know, Ukraine is getting loaded with debt, so it can't really go on financially beyond this year anyway. So, you know, people need to find an off-ramp, and I think that's where we are today.
Okay, well, I mean, Vladimir, a lot of people call this a grift here. I mean, that's one of the reasons many would say is that Zelensky is going to fight to the last Ukrainian because it's a good business model for him and his elites. And plus, he's being encouraged by so many people. It's still very bipartisan in the West. They, you know, on this program, I bring critics on all the time because they're willing to talk about it. But it still has not made an impact on many of the elites in the West. Russia can't win. That's the mantra. Go ahead, Vladimir.
That's absolutely true. And I think there is a division, and division is very simple. Common people are not very happy about it because, you know, inflation and other things. But all this kind of elites, you know, chattering classes, politicians, they are making money of it. And the same applies, of course, in Ukraine in most dire terms, because common people, they are dying in droves. Including, you know, Russians as well. But basically, what happens as far as the elites are concerned, it's ain't broken, let's not fix it, because money is coming. They ride the horse of, like, we're helping the underdog, and poor population has to pay for that with their money, with their lives, with their conveniences. And so but what is interesting, especially in Europe, what they're doing, any party, you know, the United States is different. Trump managed sort of somehow to capitalize on it and win. But in Europe, be it France, be it Germany, any party who says we have to stop it, it's not feasible. Our common people are suffering. Inflation is, you know, above the roof. They try to delegitimize these parties. So alternative voices are constantly delegitimized and so on. So, but establishment are gung-ho for the war.
Yeah, well, just cancel an election like in Romania, another great democratic experiment in the heart of Europe. It's just shameful. Pepe, there's one thing that is obvious that we should be aware of, should tell our viewers, is that escalation is always an option. It's always an option, okay? Because that's how some people interpret this. Trump is threatening, but if Putin doesn't come to the table, then you'll get my wrath. It's always there. Escalation is always a possibility. Go ahead, Pepe.
And escalation will be discussed, by the way, early next week in Brussels by a NATO EU council of notables, all of them, all the 27 will be there, and they will be talking about the armament. They will be talking about continuing this war as long as they can, with the money that they don't have, by the way, and with the famous 5% that was imposed by Trump and now is being imposed by Tutti Frutti, the NATO Secretary General, that Dutch thing. And it's beyond, as you said, it's beyond a joke. And they are inflicting on themselves. And they want to keep going with this war, even if they cannot do it. From the point of view of the industrial military complex in the US, it's a completely different proposition because they are making a lot of money out of it. So this could, from their point of view, and the fact that the Americans are not directly involved, American troops, American lives are not directly involved, is perfect. Is Slavs killing Slavs and until the last Ukrainian. So there are a lot of hidden interests, transatlantic interests, of course, that want the war to go on. Trump he sees the war purely on a cost-benefit basis. No, I don't want to pay for it. No, I have better things to do. And better things to do is tech war with China and the war that he's going to launch against many of the BRICS countries, in fact. Tariffs everywhere. It's going to be a tariff tsunami all over the place. This is what he's thinking about, not Ukraine.
Yeah, well, you know, Trump's war on the global south when it comes to sanctions and tariffs is only going to be a win for Russia and China. It's really extraordinary how myopic these people are in Washington. And again, being a diplomat and knowing diplomatic history, why can't we have a Yalta 2.0? I mean, big picture stuff, you know, another Helsinki process, you know, have a resolution to the Helsinki process resolve the issues of the Second World War. We need another one to codify the end of the Cold War and the new realities. Big picture. It doesn't have to be about Ukraine. It can be about everything, about security for all. That would work, but there is no political will for it. Ian.
Well, the UN Charter is still a good document. It's just that we've kind of cast that aside as the West has imposed this notion of a rules-based international order. So, you know, they've decodified existing rules and created an uncodified set of rules that only they can apply, you know, to countries with whom, you know, they disagree. So another conference only really works if every party is around the table on an equal basis. Until that happens, you know, if it's only going to be a Western-dominated kind of form, much like the kind of Zelensky's, you know, peace summits last year, to which, you know, Russia wasn't invited and most people didn't attend, then that's not really going to be the answer either, is it?
Well, obviously, but, you know, when you think of the NATO after the end of the Cold War, its architecture was designed against and without Russia. When I'm thinking about a Yalta 2.0, which would reconsider that. I mean, NATO is the problem here. It's not the solution. But there is no willingness to recognize that. The Russian side have said over and over and over again since the end of the Cold War, NATO expansion is something that we will not accept. And they said, finally, we don't accept it. We have Ukraine. So, I mean, let me throw this to Vladimir right now. If we have bigger thinking, it can solve smaller problems. Vladimir.
Well, what I observe, actually, and it's a pretty disturbing picture, despite all the internet, despite all this flow of information, most of the people in Europe in particular, but in the United States as well, they actually kept in the dark about Russia. What is Russian concerns? They don't exist. The only thing they hear is unprovoked, unjustifiable invasion, and they hear it day in, day out. You know, I travel a lot, and, you know, every time, you know, I like, you know, to check what's going on with RT, with Peter Lavelle's show. I cannot watch it in France. You go there, you just, oh, sorry, you know, RT doesn't exist. So basically, you know, I'm sure that people, if they work very hard, those already in the know, they might find something. But average, you know, voter in any country, France, Spain, Portugal, Germany, they don't hear much. So consequently, it's not that, you know, in order to have meaningful negotiations, meaningful sort of resolution, you have to understand where each side is coming from. They don't know where the Russians are coming from. The only thing they hear is big bad Putin and big bad Russia doing the usual thing, invading other countries. That's what they hear. And I don't know how to break through this. You know, I imagine that some politicians hear that, but obviously so far it works for them to continue their population in the dark, because this population keeps them in their places. And so it's a bad situation.
Yeah, but Pepe, you're a man that is very knowledgeable, and you're actually a hero in the Global South. I know that for a fact. In the Global South, everybody knows Pepe Escobar. It's obvious here. But they're the vast majority of the world. That's where the growth in the future is going to be. What do they think of all of this? I'm juxtaposing it from what Vladimir just said about Western audiences and publics.
Exactly. For instance, in Europe, this past 3 months, I was in NATO stan, mostly in France. And it's absolutely correct. There is absolutely no space for Russian concerns, the Russian point of view, etc. The demonization campaign and Russophobia are off the charts all the time, especially by the oligarchs who control the media in all these EU nations. Across the world is a different story. What you hear, for instance, even in Argentina, which is controlled by that change saw a demented character. People understand the Russian position, and this is discussed in academic circles, of course. In Brazil, the same thing. The average Brazilian has a soft spot for Russia, and they try to understand Russian motivations and even what caused the SMO in the first place. Across, for instance, Southeast Asia, same thing. There's a lot of Russia has a good political capital across ASEAN as well. And because of the efforts of Russian diplomats this past 2-3 years, especially, ASEAN, most of ASEAN, understands the Russian position. And no wonder that ASEAN is coming to BRICS. Now we have 4 ASEAN powerhouses as BRICS members, including Indonesia, which is a full BRICS member. There is no Russophobia across Southeast Asia, for instance. Well, China, of course, it's a chapter in itself, because China, even though Xi Jinping never approved, let's say, 100% the SMO, there are efforts by Chinese media, which, as we know, is heavily controlled, to explain the Russian position to the Chinese public. And this is well understood all across China as well. So we see only what I call NATO stand, this space which is mired in Russophobia and believing in their own propaganda.
Yeah, especially. Believing in your own propaganda. Yeah. Okay, Ian, we have 1 minute left here, and you're the diplomat on the program. Will diplomacy be key to this new administration? And I'm not thinking of only about Ukraine, but I'm thinking about West Asia or the Middle East. Is diplomacy going to be a tool that's going to be deployed, because the last administration didn't do it? Go ahead.
Well, it must be. There's been a complete departure of the diplomatic space over more than a decade, starting with the onset of the Ukraine crisis in early 2014, towards a kind of increasing militarization of Europe and elsewhere, the Middle East, as we've seen. We need to get back to the far more difficult task of actually talking to the people with whom we disagree. That needs diplomacy to come back right to the forefront for the first time in over a decade.
All right, gentlemen, absolutely, you know, blue ribbon panel, absolutely fabulous discussion. I want to thank you very much. I want to thank my guests in Providence, London, and here in Moscow. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.